You're listening to an FX PhD podcast from fxphd.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX PhD-OD, the first week of classes in the October 2013 term at FX PhD. How's it going, my friend?
It's going well, John. How are things with you?
Absolutely fantastic. Excited about the start of the new term. Excited to be heading to Mexico City for a shoot. I think we've, as we talked about last week, I think we've got a fantastic term, and I'm frankly just excited to get started.
Yeah. Actually, I was going to answer a couple of questions that I'd had. Somebody who is more recent to PhD, not a long-term, why the DOD? Why? What the hell is DOD stand for? Department of Defense? What is it with you guys? So let me answer that right off the bat. The DOD is domain of definition. It's an old concept from Shake. It's like if you had the whole picture, you could draw a box about just one part of the screen, and that's the thing that it would render. That's the thing it would focus on. And so the whole point of the DOD is that each week we draw a little kind of intellectual box in which we try and contain ourselves and focus in on. Now, I would be happy to admit that it is more than once that John and I have drifted outside the box, but that is the point of the DOD, to give you a kind of focus and a window inside PhD. Plus, I think it's really good to and healthy to have kind of a more social overlay to PhD, because, you know, one of the things that a normal university has is you get to know the people and hear from them. And so we always thought it was a good idea that you should know who we are and hear from us. So that's why we started the DOD. And I think we started the DOD back in the day, didn't we? It wasn't week one, but it was certainly in like around
it was, yeah, very, very close to week one, I think, actually, in starting. And we actually got the, did we get the name from members?
I think it was mine. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, it was yours. It's okay.
But Shake was the dominant thing. I was using Shake back when it was happening. And I always just thought, I liked that idea of, just focusing in on something, really. It seemed like an original thing to say. Plus, you know, it worked. You know, DOD and all.
Yes, it did. Sick, a little sexier sounding than crop, which or, is effectively what it'd be in Nuke if Nuke was the standard back when we started PhD.
Yeah, or this week inside FX PhD, which would be just too obvious.
Yes, exactly.
I should have had a competition. If you can tell us what DOD stood for from back in the day, we will give you something or other. But no, that's what it is. So there you go.
And we also actually, as we're talking about things that are new to people who maybe just joined us as well, I think one of the key factors that we should continue to mention is that don't rush into selecting your courses. Under the Choose Courses link under the Members tab, that's where you actually pick your courses. But if you actually, I really strongly suggest before you pick those, you actually preview the classes that we have on offer at FX PhD, and we allow you to see the first two classes in each and every single course at FX PhD before you sign up. Generally, you know, occasionally, invariably, we get several people who actually pick their courses and then a couple weeks in the term say, well, you know, I saw this course. It looks really great. Is there any way you can let me change it? And of course, we don't let you change it. No way. No, we do let you change it. So,
but, we prefer if you don't. But, yes.
But no, we do totally let you change it. But just to save yourself the trouble, us the trouble, just, you know, hold off choosing your courses until you've actually had a chance to check out the various courses we have on offer. And as the courses come out, that's the other question that we get a lot. Why aren't there any classes on my downloads page? Well, for many of the classes, they're actually being produced now, recording them each and every week during the term. For other courses, we actually kind of schedule them out during the week of the term just to kind of distribute them evenly over the course of the week. And once you sign up for that course, you'll get an email each and every time we release a new course. There's a thing that happens overnight stateside. It's early, probably midday Australia, where we run a script that actually sends all the courses out, runs the algorithm, sorts the torrents, things like that. And you'll get an email of that whenever that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the other thing is if you pick a Vault course, they are available. So it could be a little confusing. Why did my Vault course stuff come down and my non-Vault?
That's actually another question that people have. And we tried to blur the distinction. Why do you have this distinction? And bottom line is, well, there are two main reasons. The first reason is that the professor isn't available to discuss the course. The professor originally recorded the course, isn't around or is too busy in their day job to have time to answer questions in the forums. So we're unable to answer, have that aspect of the FXPHD membership. And back in the day, all of our classes used to have forums, but we were unable to run really popular courses simply because a prof wasn't available. And so this is one way in which we're able to offer some of our greatest hits from the past, so to speak. The other thing is that some of the courses are frankly on out-of-date software. That's why on the course description page, we have the software version listed in the upper right-hand corner. If you click on the Get Full Details, you can see what software version the classes were recorded in. But that being said, it may be old software, but there's a lot of really great information that's a part of that course, and we feel that you'll actually get something useful out of it. So that's another reason that we do this, is, you know, think of them as maybe not quite as current, but with lots of really great information in them.
Yeah. And let's face it, this all came from user requests. We had
yes, that's right. Why is it that way? Well, you asked for it. That's why? No.
Well, maybe not you, but your brothers and sisters in arms.
Exactly. So we do listen, and that was our compromise in adjusting things, and we have not been averse to change over the years at FXPHD.
No.
Or taking input from you guys. We're always really happy to get your input, whether it's through the contact us link or the contact help link or posting in the student forum or dropping us a line via email. My address is John Mont, JOHNMONT at FXPHD.com. Mike is Mike S, MIKES at FXPHD.com. You know, drop us a line. We're always interested in hearing from you guys.
We absolutely are. And, you know, that's all good and bad, right? Like, we don't mind it if you say, hey, I'm not enjoying something. We'd prefer to hear from you. Absolutely. So,
I don't think that we've had problems at FXPHD over the years. There have been issues. But I have to say that maybe there's been one, but I can't think of anyone contacting me that has been worse than some feedback that I got from one of my advertising agency clients. Some ridiculous comment, some stupid comment, frankly, from one of those clients. I mean, basically, even in your critique of us, we really, you guys are so professional. It's always been kind of a great community. So Mike and I can, I guess what I'm saying is we can take it.
Yeah, I was going to say, my advertising clients used to be way more annoying than anyone inside PhD. Oh my God.
Exactly. Yeah. So we've developed a very thick skin from our working with those clients. Over the years. I mean, we had some great clients too, but oh my God, if you guys.
Well, actually, I mean, you know, people need to be able to take criticism in this job, right? I mean, it's a collaborative sport. And if you can't take criticism and understand that sometimes what you may be convinced is the best idea in the world just isn't in sync with what's wanted, then you just have to go with the flow, you know. And
yeah, so the constructive criticism from you guys, which frankly it always is way better than frankly some of the non-constructive criticism that we would get at times on our job.
Yeah, there you go.
So anyway, feel free, keep the lines of communication open, and that's a large part of what this FXPHD OD is about as well.
Yeah, absolutely, so that you guys can just hear from us. And also clearly there's stuff that we discuss here that's kind of like wouldn't fit in a more serious written form. You know, we kind of go down some rat holes and discuss some cool stuff. But it's proven to be an enduringly popular thing, especially amongst those of you that have been with us for a while. So, yeah. I'm going to be publishing some stuff in background on digital faces and stuff. And we've just published our 263rd FX podcast with the Framestore Gravity guys, in particular Tim Weber. And so if you're interested in that, and obviously once the background comes out, you might want to also check out that podcast over at FX Guide. There's also a written story on FX Guide, though that is just about the film. What I'm going to be doing in background is much more on some of the evolutions and directions and sort of basically give you the differences in what's happening behind the scenes and sort of the technological approaches to digital faces. I say digital faces as opposed to fully CG faces, because this is stuff that is derived from a real person as opposed to just being sculpted in something like Mudbox. I'm talking about somebody that you want to get a digital version of Sandra Bullock or George Clooney or whoever. And there's a bunch of films that are dealing with this now. I was actually, John, writing out a list for background as to kind of the way this is going, and it just seems to be accelerating. There's a lot of talk, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago about the Uncanny Valley. But I think ever since, well, I don't know, Thor, that was still a big issue, but Social Network, certainly I think the Winklevoss twins was a really good application of a face to another person. And Benjamin Button, of course, was a landmark film. But, you know, Oblivion, Gravity, Ender's Game, which is coming up, a lot of these films do this technique now, and it's still quite complicated and cutting edge. So that's what we're going to be looking at. But I must admit, in researching this and, of course, doing the stuff with Gravity, I had a ball because that is such a cracker of a film.
Yeah, it really is. We talked about in the intro to the FX podcast, the interview with Frank Stroh VFX supervisor Tim Weber. But, boy, I was just... I got to say, Mike, it kind of actually, once again, restored my faith. I mean, there's lots of obviously great technical visual effects work in so many Hollywood films, but the combination of story plus visual effects and cinematography is really, I think, what makes Gravity stand apart. The complete package.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. It was only an $80 million film, which is not to say that it's nothing, but it wasn't, you know, that sort of 150, 200 million kind of mega thing that we've seen. Of course, it doesn't have a huge cast, but it certainly has some pretty good locations.
It was also interesting at the end in the credits how they really effectively jumped right into the visual effects and special effects crew. Mm. Obviously, simply because of the way it was shot, right?
I mean, yeah.
The kind of normal Hollywood credits for a large blockbuster film, it's quite different from that standpoint. It was interesting how that struck me, how quickly those came up at the end.
You saw it in 3D, right?
I did, and we talked about it, I think, before in the DOD. I mean, I'm not a 3D hater. However, I do think it works, you know, some films done better than others. I'm not as much of a fan of conversion in general. I loved it in Avatar. I like it in animated films quite a bit. But in this movie, I felt it really helped enhance kind of the isolation that you felt for Sandra Bullock. It really helped, I think, tell with the story. It was a perfect use case of utilizing that tool to enhance a story as opposed to just doing it from a gimmicky standpoint.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about it that's kind of interesting is that it really suited the editorial or the editing style, which is this very long shots. So having them in stereo just sort of worked well because, you know, you sort of immersed yourself in the shots as opposed to, you know, a fast-cutting sequence has a lot of trouble with sort of a stereo variation between close-ups and wides. This kind of transitioned around through these super long shots. How was that? Like, opening shot, which just went for forever. And it didn't feel like... Well, I mean, it felt like forever, but not in a bad way, if you know what I mean. Like, it felt like a really long shot. And remember, I was sitting in the cinema, I was sitting beside Ian here from our office, and I kept on saying, after about 3 or 4 minutes, I was like, it's still going. It's still the same shot.
I did the same thing.
Haven't cut yet.
I did the exact same thing, and it was mesmerizing from that standpoint. I was actually curious how long it was because I was actually not paying attention at the time to specifically how long it was, and it was nice to see that in the story that you did on Effects Guy to point out that it's 17 minutes long.
It was a long shot.
And it was a long shot, but you're right. It actually is, it helps that the comfort level as for the viewer to not have to change you know, cut to cut, readjust your eyes and so forth. So it certainly lent itself to that, I think. But yeah, I would actually, I mean, Avatar, I'd say the same thing, but even more so in this case. I think that it just really makes this, I mean, I haven't seen it in 2D, but I just think it really complements a story, enhances a story, and I'd recommend as a first screening that you see it in 3D personally.
It's a while since I've seen so many reviewers and people say you need to see this in 3D. But the general sort of press, certainly here in Australia, has been, oh, you should see this in 3D. If you get a chance, see it on the big screen, see it in 3D. I do feel that you would not get quite the same sense of awe out of seeing this, you know, like in HD at home. So if you're in a position to go see it, I really recommend that you do.
Yeah, and you guys check the article out on FX Guide. It just came out last night along with, like Mike said, the podcast as well. So also, another recent, Mike, you had a great interview that we released. I think it was last week it was with Neville Page. In FX Guy TV.
Yeah, no, that was really a joy to do. And one of the reasons that I was glad to do it is because, of course, he's a moto artist. And, you know, moto has been growing. And, of course, once it joined with the Foundry, became something that really had a lot of I don't put with this. It really has sort of gravitas because the tools, as they're integrated in with the Foundry space, validated into a VFX animation space in a way that maybe it wasn't before. That being said, Moto already had and continues to have, I'd say, a much stronger position in design than any other Foundry product. Now, there's a lot of stuff coming down the pipe, and I'm not giving anything away here because this is pretty obvious. But, for example, Moto is going to be a perfect candidate to tie in with Mari. And they don't really tie in, you know, particularly well right now, mainly because of the PTEX problems in moving models around and stuff. And just other things like the subdiv that isn't in Mari that is in, or the P subdiv, as it's called, in Moto. But that being said, it certainly was an opportunity for us to be able to push into the design space more than we possibly had in the past. Now, I guess you've probably seen this in FX PhD over the last number of years, if you've been with us, in that we started amping up our 3D component and amping up the amount of stuff that we're doing of what you might call a hardcore 3D nature. So if you take that hardcore 3D bias, or not bias, but influence we've got in PhD, mm-hmm. and couple it with this this sort of bridge that we found into the design world, then at the other side of that bridge is Neville Page. He's somebody that's worked on just a remarkable, remarkable body of work. It was funny because, you know, normally when you're doing a, I write up the little, you know, thing about FX Guide TV. It's like, oh, Neville's worked on some films. And it's like, normally you just like have three things, right? Like, you know, he's worked on Star Wars and blah, blah, and it's like, that's it. And I was like, okay, should I mention... Well, I should mention Cameron and Abrams and Ridley Scott. But hang on, what about... And, you know, it's like there was just so much stuff to draw from that he's worked on. And I was almost like, should I just put his IMDb credits in here? It was just astonishing volume of stuff. But the other thing that's really nice about him, and I'm not saying this is nothing... this is not a hint or anything else. I'm just saying, but generally speaking, he is really committed to education and to... you know, sharing with communities and stuff. And I'm not saying anything about PhD, but I'm just saying as a guy, he really sees the benefit of education. So I sort of felt a natural affinity to him. And certainly we got on like a house on fire. It was just a really enjoyable experience meeting him, doing stuff with him. And another one that, you know, just perks of the job, I guess, to get to sit down with somebody of that caliber and just, you know, work through their body of work, but also their approach to work. And he literally just is a huge Moto fan.
Yeah, and also just, I mean, I think it's also, I think you made some comments to me, it's also just nice to run into someone who is like that as well. You know, you respect their work, and then as an individual, when you meet them and spend time with them, you find out they really seem to be really good people as well.
Yeah, we have Moto courses over at PhD, of course, and this term in particular, a focus on... the new 701, but I've been, as I think we mentioned last week on the podcast, doing the previous Moto courses, or was doing the previous Moto courses in PhD, and yeah, it's a really good application. I mean, it's a really nice, clean, kind of crisp application. It has a few things that are, you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it up against, say, Houdini for, you know, particle sims work in the sense that it doesn't, you know, sort of dominate, I guess, in some of that. Doesn't have like finite element analysis or anything like that.
Right.
It does have this incredibly strong background in modeling, which of course ties in with design because designers are principally worried about modeling normally. And then it's been growing out from there. So, you know, it's a younger program and has thus very little in the way of sort of weird legacy stuff hanging around. Obviously, it's been through quite a few iterations. It's not like brand new, but I find it to be a really healthy program.
No, it is, and I think it's it really fits the bill. I think it's an approachable application. I think people find like Cinema 4D design really comfortable and familiar for motion graphics mm-hmm. designers. Obviously, it's being used a lot more in effects, but I think Moto also has this comfort level that we have. It's you know, it doesn't quite feel as technical as say a Maya does or something like that. It's a bit more. And user-friendly, it's not the right word, but a bit more approachable, I think, as well. And I'm also really interested, Mike, you mentioned integration with Mari. I'm interested in seeing. I mean, I think learning about Moto is a good way to hedge your bets. Number one, it's just good to be knowledgeable about applications in general. But I think also I'm hoping to see, you know, tighter and tighter integration between not just Moto Mari, but also Nuke as well. I have some, you know, I know it's a little hard to some come off negative, and it actually is kind of negative, but I think that Autodesk has missed a lot of opportunity in integrating their 3D apps with their compositing applications or Flame and Smoke. They've had those under house for a long time, and you'd hope to see greater and greater integration. And I'm kind of hoping to see with the Foundry maybe being a smaller, more nimble company, maybe that will kind of see some fruits of the labor of interaction between those two applications in a big way moving forward.
Well, yeah, remember in the story we did on the state of the art of rendering, we got to leak some tests that they're doing with exactly that, having, you know, having Modo and Nuke kind of tightly integrated. But we should also put into this Katana, right? Because Katana's now got this deal where it ships with a copy of RenderMan, and Katana is clearly in the 3D realm, and there's got to be connections from Modo into Katana as well. So I think the biggest single product category that's not in the arsenal of the Foundry right now would be, I guess, color grading, would you say? They don't really have a per se DaVinci-esque kind of product, but in those other areas, in between the 3D and the modeling and the texturing and lighting and stuff.
Raw editorial, maybe. I mean, Hero's getting there. You could see the writing on the wall with Hero, potentially. The future, I guess, not the writing on the wall, but potential for it in the future. But yeah.
Yeah. Which brings an interesting question, doesn't it? I mean, if you were running a Foundry-type company, what do you think the future of editorial is? Is it a complete finishing, let's ignore the whole fact that we once had offline and online? Or is there still some real workflow stuff that you want to have a more offline online approach? Because I've got to say, with Premiere and stuff, you know, I used to think of products like Avid as being, you know, very much not finishing products. But now, you know, I mean, you just, that line is so broken down.
I think it comes into the type of work that you're doing still at this point. I think that if you're managing very large projects with large data sets, organizing, you know, significant material, there are some shortcomings Premiere that fall apart. And I would say Smoke also shows that as well, that if you're going to do some kind of creative editorial on large volumes of footage with cutdowns, frankly, Avid is superior to that specific type of editing. You can break it down, I understand, Premiere and so forth, but there is a certain type of, say, you know, film, movie, commercials that Avid is a little more robust at this point in time for dealing with those large data sets. Not to say there aren't people doing it. I mean, there certainly are, but it just overall, it's a bit smoother in that application.
So would that be what, if you were suddenly appointed god of a Foundry-style company, you'd go after? Because...
No, I don't know. I don't necessarily think so. I guess my thing was asking your comment about the necessary merging of offline and online. I do think there's a certain... type of editing that is served by one style of application, at least so far, and then another that's served by a different style that's a little bit less, doesn't need to focus as much at those large data sets. So
it would seem to me that a company like the Foundry that isn't an Adobe, it's not, you know, got that huge mega wide user base, a more obvious solution would be to go for a higher end Avid style will deal with vast data sets complexity editor than to go in with the cheap and cheery, not cheap and cheery, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't think there's a lot of competition out there right now at that level either. And if you think that could actually tie in with some of the scriptable, I think that's another aspect that could really serve to see advancement in editorial is, you know, interop and scriptability to facilitate workflow. I think that could be an interesting place to see a lot of improvements done in how you get from that offline stage to finishing stage, make that bridge easier.
Yeah, I hadn't actually thought about that, but yeah, if you had a really scriptable, customizable editing sort of, you know, that sort of approach where you almost say, oh my God, it's almost got to an operating system level. It's so flexible and structurable. There's real options for that in Hero, because I mean we see a lot of customizable stuff in Hero from companies that have been doing in that Hero is very open to doing that, though it doesn't own the media in the way that a Premiere or an Avid does.
I think there's I could be off base completely in this and consider old school, but I think it's actually really difficult to make one product do a lot of things well. I just think even from a UI standpoint, Toxic was going to be the same infrastructure under the hood, and if you were editing, you were presented with one UI or working paradigm. If you're doing effects, it was another, color grading another. Well, that makes sense to me, but to try and throw everything into the same thing and say it works for everybody, I don't think that the standard timeline layer-based approach with the source and record window works well for effects. Doesn't even work, in my opinion, necessarily great for motion graphics. So that's the other complexity in doing that. You know, maybe you focus on those specific tasks, and like you say, that could be, you know, you focus on this really hardcore enterprise, big level feature film, episodic television editing market, and have each application do its job really well. But the sauce is the interaction and underpinnings and the way you get data back and forth between the applications that's seamless. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's one thing, though, we've seen is when you come up with a radical new UI approach to editing, boy, you better still have a lot of old school tools in there.
What are you talking about?
Yes, if you want to get lynched by the editing community, to suggest that the old preview window and record window is a bad idea and that traditional timelines suck.
I don't have enough hours in the day, but I would like to take another look and see what has changed in that application. That application was, of course, Final Cut that Mike's, I think, alluding to.
It's dead to me.
But frankly, I just don't have the time to do it. And yes, so for the same reason, it's dead to me as well. I mean, but I'm just curious. That's all I guess I'm saying.
Oh, I understand that. Yeah, the curiosity thing. But, you know, I was talking to someone about this the other day. They were saying, you know, this is a much better product than that. And I said, you just can't judge products on a feature list set and ignore adoption. Like, the trouble is that, you know, it just isn't a valid thing to say this is a better solution. This is a better possible solution if it gets wide scale adoption, if it doesn't lose the community, if it can get people to, you know, buy into its way of operating. Because to build a better mousetrap is not enough. You really need, in this day and age, a solid user connection that allows it to then, you know, flourish. And I'm sorry, like, the picking it on features ain't gonna cut it. I mean, how many times do you need to hire freelancers and move stuff around? And if you just don't play well with others and you don't have a good, you know, operational base, it just doesn't matter.
It's very true nowadays, but has been true all along, frankly. I was just reminded of this when I was back in Indiana helping my parents pack up the house that I grew up in, and I stumbled across our old Betamax machine. And of course, being the guy in high school who was totally into TV and editing, and, you know, at that age, actually from elementary school on, I was so into it. You know, I convinced my parents to get a Beta machine because it was far superior technology.
And yeah, it was. I'm not arguing with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, but I think too, I think it's even more critical now. I mean, that's a slightly different reason, but I do think you're right, Mike. It's certainly, I think, even more important nowadays.
I was in a meeting with some equipment manufacturers, and they were asking me to sort of assess some technology. And I was like, look, really, it isn't worth my time, unless I believe this product has some legs, to invest. Because you make a huge personal commitment learning a new piece of software and adopting it and setting it all up and stuff. And you just can't do that on a whim. You know, no one has enough bandwidth to be able to say, well, I'm going to become really proficient in this entirely different thing over here on the off chance that I might learn something from it, you might learn something from it, and we, you know, we can go again. It just doesn't work that way. And so I was like, when you get to a more stable point, you know, I'll reconsider. But right now, I just can't be... It's not that I couldn't be bothered. It's just like... It is such a commitment, and there's muscle memory, and there's just, you know, workflows, and there's associated gazillion things that go on. And, you know, the resistance to swapping, the resistance to change is really big for good reasons. So, I know, I don't think Final Cut has much of a chance of being able to claw back that user community that they lost, and that's a shame, but I just think it's a reality. They wouldn't do something.
It's also, yeah, the reality also becomes having a talented base of artists to which you can use the application as well, or editor. I mean, that's actually a huge factor in running a business. It's a huge factor actually in the discussions that we have with the manufacturers, studio owners, facilities. You know, what are they seeing shortcomings in the number of artists they need for their job? And that helps determine, frankly, some of the courses that we have, or a lot of the courses we have at FX PhD for that reason, you know, helping those people find the people who can run that product. And we're not getting a big call for people needing new Final Cut editors.
Yeah, and it's harsh because, I mean, it's different when a product is new and there's potential out there and people are keen to see, you know. So I'm not saying that. But once a product is already existing and they've kind of lost people, swinging them back, that's killer hard. If you are in a situation that you come up with a new product that has some real merits and some real stuff, well, obviously you stand a chance of gaining traction, and we're all for being able to provide an opportunity for people to explore that. But I've got to say, yeah, the other way around, where you're kind of having people drift away, once that sort of sets in, man, that's harsh. That is harsh. But... you know, Apple only has itself to blame. I think it wasn't just that, of course. It wasn't just this one single decision. It was coupled with other stuff, like the fact that there was very little in the way of commitment to you know, new towers and stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And again, well, I mean, again, that loss is actually one reason why we are, you know, in the last several terms, had so many more courses related to Adobe's Creative Cloud workflow.
Yep,
because, you know, frankly, they're you know, pretty much kicking it. I would say I think it's quite impressive what they have added in the last several releases. And again, you know, just stuff that we talked about last week coming out in the release due in October with the enhanced connection between SpeedGrade and Premiere. I mean, we'll be able to separate how it works. This is the promise of how it works, but that's just one example in the kind of workflow that they're trying to improve between their products.
Yep.
And part of us helping you guys keep up to date on that stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know if there's anything else you want to discuss this week. We sort of seem to have bounced around editing software.
I'm excited to hang up because I just, you know, one of the bad things about moving out to LA was I lost another piece of gear, I realized.
I know.
I told you over the weekend, and I may have been stolen, my 70-200 yeah. lens, which was a really, really bad loss, but I lost my Nodal Ninja. And so I was getting that together for the shoot in Mexico City. I'm like, I don't have one. So I had to, of course, buy the new improved, Nodal Ninja, with the new rotator, the more expensive rotator on it that has, better locking, more stops, more clicks. I got the one with the RD16.
Does it have the go fast stripes on it?
So I'm eager to play with that, the go fast stripes. Yeah. No. But yeah, so I'm chomping at the bit to kind of play around and give that a spin. I mean, it's not that much different from the old one, but I think the new rotator is actually much nicer than the previous one.
Okay, good to know.
Which will be nice to shoot the panoramas for the plates, HDR panoramas that I'm shooting for.
Well, hopefully next week we can have a discussion about how your shoot went.
Yes, for sure. Looking forward to it.
Plan.
Yes, as we joked yesterday when I talked to you on the phone, is don't get kidnapped.
Yeah, that would be awesome if you didn't get kidnapped. And just for anyone listening who's thinking of kidnapping John, I don't have that much money to pay for a ransom.
And Eduardo, I am jesting. Joking, of course. But anyway, yes, let's wrap it up for this week. Again, if you guys have any questions, post in the forums. Those of you who are new to FX PhD and the DoD, thanks for taking the time to listen. Again, we do try to make this a valuable podcast to listen to, but also give you some insight into what's happening behind the scenes, I guess you could say, at FX PhD. So thanks for taking the time to listen.
See you guys.
Thanks for listening. This podcast is copyright FX PhD.